From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. NBA money has been flying as teams scramble to sign the biggest and the best free agents. Ahead on Only a Game, what some teams will do to make good impressions on the objects of their affection. Also, trap shooting quickly becomes Minnesota's fastest-growing school sport. Step into the van of the dreadlocked man who knocked Rafael Nadal out of this year's Wimbledon tournament. And Calvin Coolidge becomes the latest president to join the race in Washington. Also ahead, the Army's Combatives program teaches an intense form of hand-to-hand MMA-style combat, but is it good for its soldiers?
There's a lot of soldiers that have PTSD and that like to fight because it helps take their mind off of things that have happened.
Well, I wouldn't recommend it for any individuals who have PTSD because it only reinforces those kinds of experiences you've had.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Women's World Cup final, a rematch between the U.S. and Japan, will transpire on Sunday. The stadium in Vancouver is expected to be full, but one significant personage will be absent, which brings us to the first of the three stories you should know, our weekly discussion of sports stories you might have missed. This week, our segment features George Vesey, author of 8 World Cups, and Rob Nyer, senior baseball editor for Fox Sports. Welcome to you both.
Great to be here.
My pleasure.
George, since I have already mentioned the Women's World Cup, and because it is your birthday weekend, as I understand it, why don't you go first? Happy birthday. Who is the VIP who has announced that he will not be present at the Women's World Cup final?
Well, of all people, the man who never missed a photo opportunity, Sepp Blatter, will not be flying to Northern America. Because of all his legal trouble, he has decided that he's going to stay close to home in the vault in Switzerland, in one of his numbered Swiss bank accounts. And as soon as I heard that Blatter was not flying over North American territory, I was reminded of the great movie, The White Knights, where Baryshnikov is forced to land in Siberia. He's a Soviet defector, and he lands in Siberia, and they bring him into Moscow or Leningrad or someplace and say, you know, how would you like to do us a favor for your old home country? And I could just see Blatter somehow landing in the United States on his way to Canada, and Loretta Lynch meeting him at the airport in Billings, Montana, and saying, would you like to come with me? I've got a piece of paper for you.
Rob, what do you think? Is the truth stranger than fiction in this case? Is this why Sepp Blatter is staying home rather than coming to Canada?
Well, I read a report somewhere that said he was remaining in Switzerland for personal reasons. And I think not being arrested is a tremendous personal reason. I mean, it's my favorite, actually.
I do have another theory about why Mr. Blatter won't be at the game. He didn't recognize Marta at a fairly recent award ceremony. He was once asked how to make women's soccer more popular, and his answer was, put him in shorter shorts. Now, this is a guy who hasn't exactly distinguished himself in terms of his knowledge or his enthusiasm for women's soccer. So I think even if he weren't in danger of being arrested, he might have found something that he'd rather do that day.
You're assuming that he has any kind of normal shame, but he has made a fool of himself in many ways. To be fair, under his regime, FIFA has expanded women's soccer. The Women's World Cup is now up to 24 teams, which leads to fun new teams like Colombia, England going further than it ever did before.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, George, because the tournament has been terrifically entertaining, as we anticipated. Rob, you're next. What's your story that you think listeners should know about?
Well, I think it might be the most interesting, if not the best story, this season in baseball, and that is Alex Rodriguez's career resurgence. Monday, Major League Baseball will announce the reserve players for this year's All-Star Game. Ken Rosenthal, my colleague at Fox Sports, argues that Alex Rodriguez belongs on the All-Star team. This would be an even better story, if only because of its unlikelihood just a few months ago. But, you know, I'm wondering, what do you guys think? Is he a worthy All-Star? Is he an appropriate All-Star, considering his history?
George, I'm going to let you answer that first. Are you among those celebrating A-Rod 2.0?
Well, coming from the Sepp Blatter view of the world, what's inappropriate these days? And if Alex Rodriguez is the best player on the Yankees, and I, from my Mets-centric retired point of view, I seem to notice that he is, I say he deserves it.
Statistically, I think Alex Rodriguez deserves to be there. There's little question about that. The only full-time DH with a better case is probably Prince Fielder, and I'm not sure it's better. But maybe we also should give him some credit, whether that's all-star credit or just good karma that we all sent his way for having such a great year, such a great bounce back, such a great comeback. We all love comeback stories. This was a guy who was reviled in almost every quarter. Most people, including me, thought he'd never play again, or certainly not for the Yankees. And yet he's done everything right this spring and summer, said all the right things, kept his nose clean, hasn't made a big fuss about the $6 million that the Yankees might or might not owe him for catching Willie Mays on the all-time home run list. So I'm all for it.
The Yankees and A-Rod have now agreed that $3.5 million in bonus money should be paid to charities instead. And this is good, because I think it's fair to say that he's one of the few people on the planet who could find $6 million between the sofa cushions, right?
Well, I mean, he did forfeit many millions of salary when he was suspended for an entire season.
Okay, my topic seems appropriate to the 4th of July, or at least it does to me. At Daytona this weekend, NASCAR fans can exchange their Confederate flags for American flags. NASCAR has discouraged fans from flying Confederate flags, but has stopped short of banning them. Officials at Daytona said this week they couldn't outright ban the Confederate flags because fans had already purchased tickets for the event. One fan who chose to fly a flag this weekend told reporters, "We're not doing it for hate, but we do have rights." So has that fan got it right? Is this a free speech issue, or has NASCAR's response to this controversy been timid?
I think it would be a little dangerous to ask somebody who's already flapping a Confederate flag, you know, to give it up. But if you can educate or prepare to say, look, we're frowning on it these days, I would say it's a good start. Outright banning it, I mean, the guy has a point, free speech.
What do you think, Rob?
Well, it's not, I don't think it's technically a free speech issue because this isn't a government trying to ban something. There are t-shirts that you can't wear into sporting venues.
Right.
So you could theoretically do the same thing. You could get rid of the flags. And frankly, I think that's probably where we're headed. I just doubt if it's going to happen immediately. That would be a shock to everyone's system. It's probably 5-10 years down the road.
So you would go along with this rationalization, which is people have already bought tickets thinking they could bring their flags in, so we can't ban them now because then they would say, hey, we didn't know this when we bought our tickets.
No, that's a specious argument. Just because you can't bring your flag doesn't mean you can't use your tickets. I think it's really just about not wanting to cause a bigger stir than absolutely necessary. It's just too soon.
George, you want the final word on this one?
I've covered a bunch of Daytonas, and I understand regional pride. I've lived and worked in the South. I just think, given the horrors that took place in Charleston, that any step you can take, I say NASCAR can't do it all at once, but anything they can do to move it along is certainly welcome.
My guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been veteran sports writer and author George Vesey and Rob Nyer, who's senior baseball editor for Fox Sports. Rob, thanks very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And George, a pleasure to have you with us again. Thank you.
Anytime, man. Thank you.
Lots of NBA players are signing autographs these days at the bottoms of great big new contracts. Some free agents have stuck with their current teams, as Anthony Davis has in New Orleans, to the tune of $145 million for a 5-year extension. Others are flirting with lots of potential employers. As NBA teams court top-flight free agents, they often skip the hard sell and the soft sell in favor of the over-the-top razzle-dazzle sell. Arash Markazi has written about the most memorable sales pitches for ESPN.com. Let's start with the courtship of LeBron James back in 2010. First, what did Cleveland do to try to keep James?
LeBron James's favorite cartoon is The Family Guy. So they created a cartoon basically with a lot of inside jokes and really pulling at the heartstrings of LeBron James as if to say, listen, you're from here, you know us, we know your friends, you get these inside jokes. But it was interesting. At that point in LeBron James's career, he was not looking for that. He was looking at something new. Pat Riley came in. Now, Pat Riley won a championship as a player with the Lakers. He won 5 championships as a coach with the Lakers, and he won another championship with the Heat. And he laid all the 7 championship rings across the table from LeBron James, and he said, you come to Miami, LeBron, and you can build your own collection. And that convinced him, well, I'm going to go to Miami.
Dwight Howard became a free agent in 2013 after spending one season with the Lakers. The team put up billboards all around Los Angeles urging him to stay, but the Dallas Mavericks played to Howard's love of Superman, and they made a video, a cartoon, depicting Howard coming to Earth from another planet to win NBA championships. How is it possible he didn't sign with Dallas?
For LeBron James, five teams came to him. The same was the case with Dwight Howard, where Mark Cuban said, you could be Superman here with the Mavericks. You can win championships, build your brand. Dwight Howard's 1 year in Los Angeles was so bad. From all accounts, that meeting was the most contentious of them all because they basically said how much they did not like playing with each other, how much that one season was not good. So despite all the billboards throughout Los Angeles, there was really no chance Dwight Howard was going to stay with the Lakers. And listen, I think the Mavericks were in contention, but at the end of the day, he went to Houston.
Back in 1999, then Dallas coach and general manager Don Nelson arranged for free agent Gary Trent and his family to stay at Nelson's vacation home in Hawaii. About the same time, the Sacramento Kings sent several players on an expenses-paid trip to Las Vegas, perhaps hoping they'd go broke and have to sign with the team that sent them. I don't know. Anyway, both those teams were fined. I guess team executives know they have to be a little more careful these days.
Exactly. And I think that's why you have this new setup where teams travel to the agency. So, for example, with LeBron James, they traveled to Cleveland. And in Dwight Howard's case, they traveled in Los Angeles. It is awkward, though, because some of these meetings run long. And in the case of LeBron James in 2010, the Brooklyn Nets and the New York Knicks crossed paths, one walking into the meeting, one walking out of the meeting.
It seems hard to believe now, but there was a time when Spurs big man Tim Duncan considered leaving San Antonio. This was back in 2000 when, as you write, he had yet to become as synonymous with the city as the Alamo and the Riverwalk. Tell us about the Orlando Magic sales pitch.
Yes, at that point, Tim Duncan was 24. He's coming off his third season with the Spurs. They really went after Tim Duncan hard. They flew him and his wife on a private plane to Orlando, took him golfing with Tiger Woods. Dr. J was working with the Magic at that point. He talked to him. They wined him and dined him to the point that Greg Popovich really got the sense that he was gone. Popovich convinced him to stay, although Tim Duncan told Greg Popovich, there's no beaches in San Antonio, to which Popovich responded, there's no beaches in Orlando either.
Arash Markazi wrote about the most memorable NBA free agent sales pitches for ESPN.com. Arash, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tennis fans could be forgiven for not knowing the name of the 102nd best tennis player on the men's tour until Thursday. That's when Dustin Brown knocked Rafael Nadal, winner of 14 Grand Slam titles, out of Wimbledon. In his post-match press conference, Brown, wearing a Rasta hat and a Superman t-shirt, called it the best day of my life.
I think all the kids that play tennis dream on, you know, being able to play on that center court and then also to be able to put that performance together. This was definitely very difficult, and I'm very happy that I held it together for the whole match.
Here's a couple of tidbits you might not know about Dustin Brown. He was born in Germany, but moved to Jamaica when he was 11. He hasn't cut his dreadlocks in 19 years, and he credits his current place on the tour to time spent in a Volkswagen camper van. For more on that, we turn to Sports Illustrated senior writer Greg Bishop, who profiled Brown for the New York Times back in 2010. Hi, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
In 2010, Brown was still working his way up the rankings. He had broken into the top 100 for the first time, was about to make his first appearance at Wimbledon in the singles draw. But was his story really all about the van for you?
Yeah, definitely. The van is one thing that really stuck with me. You know, he's got such an interesting backstory, just, you know, being German and Jamaican and having lived all over the world. But my favorite part of the story was, you know, that his mother decided at one point that, you know, for him to be successful, they were going to have to buy a camper van, live in the camper van, and travel around Europe to these, you know, smaller tournaments to try and crack the top 100. And so, you know, he did that, and he did it for many years. And, you know, that part of it always really stood out to me.
You point out that the van was, quote, bigger than some Manhattan apartments with a kitchen, a bathroom, and three beds. It sounds pretty good to me. Why did he ever give it up?
Yeah, you know, I think what happened was he ultimately lived in it as long as he had to, and then when he ended up being able to live in a, you know, a full space, he kept the van. My understanding is he still has it, and he might drive it occasionally for the errand, or, you know, if he's got a date, he might take it to the movies. But, yeah, I think ultimately he just kind of outgrew it, although I do believe he kept it for sentimental value.
Jamaica, of course, is known for its sprinters, not necessarily for its tennis players. How much more difficult did it become for Brown to become a professional tennis player when his family moved to Jamaica?
You know, he said it was really hard. He had a hard time finding courts. He had a hard time finding just tennis balls that were, like, in great shape. He had a hard time finding people to play against. And, you know, they obviously have great weather all year round, so it's possible to train, but it's just not a very popular sport. And so, you know, that was kind of what got him to get the van in the first place, is that, he, you know, he felt like the longer he stayed in Jamaica, the less fit he would be known, and the less that he could kind of move up. So then they got the van, took the risk, drove around Europe, and you know, it all led to that moment with the big win over Nadal.
The Jamaican Tennis Federation, I gather, was not particularly supportive.
No, when I interviewed Brown in 2010, he had told me that he had received an email from the Federation president congratulating him for his wild card entry into Wimbledon. And the only problem with that is that he was ranked 101st for the tournament, and he didn't need a wild card at all. And so that, to him, signaled that they weren't really paying that much attention. So, you know, it'll be interesting now. You know, a lot of times you'll see these kind of federations try to, you know, get some glory out of a big win like that. And so it'll be interesting to see how they react to it.
Brown is the talk of Wimbledon this week. His Twitter page, at Dreddy Tennis, has tens of thousands of new followers. No surprise there. But champions get ousted at Wimbledon every year. Why are we so fascinated with this particular upset?
You know, it's a good point, because if you look at the match just in and of itself, you know, Nadal's worst surface is grass. Brown's best surface is grass. It's not entirely that surprising. I think what makes it, interesting to people is just Brown's story. I think the hair really stands out, especially at a place like Wimbledon. I think the way he plays with the serve and volley game that's largely extinct for men's tennis and used to be very popular there. And I think it's just the backstory. You know, I hate to keep coming back to the van, but I think people just latch on to a guy that took a risk and decided, I'm going to try to do this and do it well. And then to have it culminate, people really identify with that.
You know, to be entirely fair to Mr. Brown, we probably should point out that this win was not exactly a fluke. His record against Rafael Nadal is 2-0.
Exactly, and he's very good on grass. You know, he's very tall. He hits a hard serve. He's good at coming in, and, you know, it's the perfect surface for him. He's beaten Nadal on grass before in Germany, and if somebody was going to come in and beat Nadal, who's slumped on grass in recent years, never been that comfortable on it, you know, it shouldn't be that surprising that it was Dustin Brown.
Greg Bishop is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. You can link to his 2010 profile of Dustin Brown, a Wimbledon journey that began in a van, at onlyagame.org. Greg, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Recently, 108 members of the Army came together in Alaska for 2 days of unsanctioned fighting. It's an annual tradition, with soldiers convening in a cage to try out their hand-to-hand combat skills. The tournament fits loosely within the Army's evolving standards for what constitutes a battle-ready soldier. But as Only a Game's Zachariah Hughes reports, the MMA-style fighting has less to do with battle readiness than it does with helping soldiers cope with problems they experience as the military draws down after more than a decade of combat abroad.
Sergeant John Medeiros and I are about the same size, except one of us is covered in muscles and tattoos, and the other has on skinny jeans and is holding a tape recorder. We're at the back of a gymnasium on Fort Richardson, near Anchorage, and it's day two of what the U.S. Army stationed in Alaska calls its Combatives Tournament. Nearby is the octagonal cage, where soldiers have come together to beat each other up. Medeiros is a favorite to win in his weight class after several savage victories the day before, which he recaps to a passing friend.
I got 2 bow and arrows, I got a cross collar choke, and a Kimura with an inverted triangle.
Shut up.
The tournament is voluntary. It's a chance for soldiers who want to test their skills with the Army's in-house fighting style, which in military jargon is called the Modern Army Combatives Program, or MACP. But everyone just calls it combatives. Like Krav Maga in the Israeli military and Sambo in Russia, combatives is a hybrid martial art that U.S. Army troops are expected to be proficient in.
Would you like to get punched in the face?
Staff Sergeant Matthew Jones is the incoming director of the Combatives Program here at Fort Richardson, and he says the program's roots stretch back to the 90s, when Army brass heard from troops that their hand-to-hand training was irrelevant and obsolete. Just think of pugil sticks, those giant Q-tips you whack around like boat oars. Those were meant to simulate fighting an enemy with a fixed bayonet. So the Army started over.
We sent some guys to other countries. We went to Brazil, Thailand, Japan. We went to Russia. And we took all those skills and geared it towards a battlefield-ready soldier.
The result is a mashup that looks, to the untrained eye, like MMA. Some cautious boxing, a few kicks, then a slam to the mat, heralding a parade of chokes, arm bars, and leg locks. It's serious business.
There's a lot of soldiers that have PTSD and that like to fight because it helps take their mind off of things that have happened.
Sergeant Sean Ehrenhold is the outgoing director of the Combatives Program on base. He is huge, by my estimates, about three radio reporters wide. The only reason he's not competing is because of his referee duties, but he's in his element, stalking around the octagon, wearing sanitary surgical gloves as others spar. Most matches don't make it beyond the first round, ending in grimace-inducing submissions, and one knockout even brings medics scurrying onto the mat. Combatives programs vary from base to base. Some commanders aren't too enthused and have banned tournaments to keep active duty soldiers from risking unnecessary injury. That's not the case in Alaska. There's a required course on the basics of hand-to-hand, and many choose to take more intensive courses.
Maybe this is a dumb question. What's it like to get knocked out?
It's actually pretty cool.
Aaron Holt is one of the program's most vocal defenders and insists it's far more than just blood sport. In modern war zones, soldiers may be going on house-to-house raids or conducting traffic stops and need to know how to react. Things get physical. That's why instructors practice chokeholds on each other, along with something called an Option 3 drill.
And what it is we take people or soldiers that have never been punched in their face before, and we punch them in the face. It's not a rite of passage. It's a technique to show, hey, you can get hit in the head or in the body and still be able to perform what you need to do to gain dominance.
But most of the guys I talk with say that for them, combatives is more about dealing with stress, be it post-traumatic or otherwise. Not everyone thinks this is a good way to cope, though. Dr. Philip Baker is a clinical psychologist in Anchorage who works with veterans recovering from trauma. He says aggression in the cage may temporarily help depression and stress, but does nothing to work through the underlying source.
Well, I wouldn't recommend it for any individuals who have PTSD. It does distract you, and it does feel good to be physical like that again, but it doesn't help you in the long run get rid of it because it only reinforces of those kinds of experiences you've had.
Baker concedes that it may help some as therapy, but believes it isn't worth the risks.
It possibly could be of benefit, but I personally, there's so many other ways of fighting that are much more eloquent, and they're not so dangerous or for head injuries and broken bones and things.
Took a couple to the temple and then to the jaw and just kind of dazed me for a second. It didn't work out in my favor.
John Medeiros lost his final tournament bout for the middleweight title, but is taking it in stride, albeit with a slight limp. And unlike Dr. Baker, Medeiros is unequivocal that this helps.
I don't think I would have made it through a lot of the adversities I have in life if I hadn't built the mental strength that I have through putting myself in some crazy scenarios, and I was mentally strong enough to make it through those things because of my history. I don't have time to sit there and dwell on the things that are bothering me in life and stressing me out when my training partners and my coaches are trying to choke me and break my arms.
I asked him about those adversities in his life, but he didn't want to go into details. Now, Medeiros, who was trained in wrestling and jiu-jitsu since high school, spends a good deal of his time coaching other fighters, in part to pay forward the help he got early on.
A top priority right now in the military in general is there's a lot of suicides going on and people that just feel alone and don't have that outlet for that stress. But if I can introduce jiu-jitsu and combatives to one person that it's able to help put them in a better place and give them a better outlook on life, then I've done something positive.
With the cage nearly dismantled, bags of ice doled out, and zero reporters punched in the face, this year's combatives tournament came to a close. Medeiros' plan for celebrating that weekend was to eat a giant meal, play with his dog, and begin healing for all the fights to come. For Only a Game, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage.
There's a new entrant in the president's race. No, we're not talking Republicans and Democrats looking toward the 2016 election. It's the fourth inning mascot race at Washington Nationals home games that we have in mind. Calvin Coolidge joined that race on Friday night, running alongside Teddy Roosevelt, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abe Lincoln, and William Howard Taft. I spoke earlier this week to Valerie Camillo, Chief Revenue and Marketing Officer for the Nationals. Camillo said the mascot based on the 30th president took his opportunity seriously.
Yes, he's been putting in his wind sprints. We've got him his Under Armour shoes. He's getting ready for the big day. So he's working out, and we've seen him in some preliminary trials. He's doing pretty good. He's holding his own.
Coolidge owes his chance at mascot glory to a partnership between the Nationals and the White House Historical Association. The latter group, which releases a new Christmas tree ornament each year, has decided this year to honor Silent Cal, and that provided Coolidge with the opportunity to join the race at Nationals Park. Given the company he's joining, particularly George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, Calvin Coolidge's credentials for elite mascot status might be questioned, but then again, there's Taft, perhaps the least likely runner among all past presidents. Anyway, Valerie Camillo was quick to defend Coolidge's inclusion in the race.
There's a lot of reasons why Coolidge is a good fit. Coolidge was the last president that threw out the first pitch for a Washington-based team in the World Series, so maybe he'll bring us some luck.
Maybe so. Still, doubts persist, at least in the mind of the Washingtonians Ben Fried. After some diligent investigative work, Ben Fried has discovered, well, I'll let him tell you about what he has uncovered. Ben, what did you learn about President Coolidge's passion for baseball?
Well, I found that it didn't really exist.
Coolidge did attend some games, though, right?
He did attend a lot of season openers, and he attended several games of the 1924 World Series that the Washington Senators won. But whether or not he actually saw the Senators ever win a game, well, maybe not. There are a lot of reports of him leaving games in the fourth inning or the seventh inning, or as soon as a little bit of rain came along. So did he stay for all nine innings or extra innings? It doesn't look that way.
Let me just get this straight, Ben. President Coolidge attended World Series games and left early?
Many of the games that he attended, he did not stay for the whole time, which is mediocre fan etiquette in the regular season, I think a lot of people would say, and in the playoffs is unthinkable.
However, Grace Coolidge, his wife, was a serious baseball fan, right? We can document that.
Grace Coolidge might be the biggest baseball fan to ever live in the White House, and I know that includes a guy who owned the Texas Rangers. By all accounts, she stayed through games. She stayed through rain delays. She kept a box score for herself. She got peanuts from the vendors, and she was a lifelong fan. This was not just a temporary fixation for her while she was first lady. She actually got a lifetime pass from the American League and went to games for pretty much all her life. There's a letter from her sometime in the early 1950s when she wrote a friend, "I venture to say that not one of you cares a hoot about baseball, but to me it is my very life."
What a wonderful quotation. That's terrific. So I wonder if you're willing to go far enough out on a limb to say that the Nationals really got it all wrong. Should be Grace Coolidge racing in the fourth inning.
I think they should swap Coolidges. Calvin Coolidge had plenty of accomplishments as president, but being a real baseball fan was not one of them.
Ben Fried is a staff writer for The Washingtonian. You can link to his story, "The Nationals Are Putting the Wrong Coolidge on the Field," at onlyagame.org. Ben, thank you very much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
This week, for a Where Are They Now feature, Jose Canseco told Sports Illustrated that he wishes he'd never written his tell-all, or at least tell-a-lot, book, Juiced. The book was published 10 years ago. In it, Canseco, who hit 462 home runs over a 17-year career spent with seven teams, acknowledged his own steroid use. The book also included the names of various teammates who'd used performance-enhancing drugs, at least according to the author. I can understand why Mr. Canseco, who turned 51 on Thursday, might regret writing the book. While some of the prominent former players he named in Juiced have made their apologies and found their way back into baseball as players or coaches, Canseco has essentially been blackballed by the baseball establishment. This is not hard to understand for reasons that go beyond Canseco's book. Jose Canseco also shot his finger off, by accident, to be sure, but still, shooting your finger off is no way to land a job in Major League Baseball. Neither is illegally transporting drugs across the border from Mexico, reckless driving, aggravated battery, domestic violence, or illegal possession of a handgun, or violating one's parole. Canseco has been charged with all of these things and convicted of some of them. As Casey Stengel used to say, you could look it up. Beyond that, it took Canseco a while to regret Juiced. In fact, 4 years after the book came out, he said, "What I speak out of my mouth is the truth. It burns like fire." It's not Flaubert, but it's not bad. That assertion didn't help him any with Major League Baseball, but who can deny that the lexicon would be poorer without Jose Canseco's contribution? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Fans, Fanatics, and Fanaticus, an examination of fan misbehavior in Latin, or at least one word of it is Latin. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and hello to our new friends at WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Our subjects today, or at least two of them, will be money and heartbreak, two staples of contemporary sports. Money first. On the first day of free agency, NBA teams spent a combined $1.4 billion. Is this because this year's free agents are especially worthy?
Well, that's part of it. But the other part of it is that there is more TV money coming in, and we're going to wind up with a salary cap in the NBA of $108 million. And a luxury tax threshold of $127 million, which means you can pay your roster $127 million before you have to kick in anything to the league.
So in the context of today's NBA, there is no such thing as too much.
No, absolutely not, apparently. I mean, there's a league that was supposedly on the downward slide a couple years ago.
We learned this week that for fighting Manny Pacquiao in May, Floyd Mayweather made $220 million. Mr. Pacquiao made somewhere around $150 million. Should this be considered too much, since people are happy to invest in pay-per-view TV and the cable companies are happy to oblige them?
Well, I mean, you never really know about the boxing money, to be honest with you. I mean, that's what they say it is. It's sort of like NFL contracts, but another layer of corruption. But this is fairly standard now. And again, another sport thought to be dying, being revived by television money.
I understand that there's a good deal of money in professional golf, and Phil Mickelson is a very good professional golfer, but we're not concerned with how much he's earning on the course these days, right?
No, he's all tangled up in all sorts of stuff now. He's being accused of essentially laundering money in a sports gambling operation to the tune of about $3 million. Last year, it was the FBI and the Securities Exchange Commission that were after him because he could have been involved in insider trading. I don't know why he just doesn't put it in a mattress at this point.
All right, on to the heartbreak. What happened? I can't believe you're laughing at this, because you and I saw the same thing. What happened to Laura Bassett of England's women's soccer team Wednesday night should not happen to any soccer player, at least while a lot of people are watching. She knocked England out of the Women's World Cup with an own goal in stoppage time. Kate Fagan of ESPN tweeted, "I want to give Laura Bassett the biggest hug ever." Has she said it all, or do you have something to add?
Look, kick it to the side. Mm-hmm. Don't kick it towards your goal. I know nothing about soccer, and I know this. And, of course, it was Great Britain, which always makes me laugh. But as we've spoken about, the United States and Japan is a nice rivalry.
Absolutely.
And that's your World Cup final.
When those teams faced each other in the final 4 years ago, the U.S. experienced the heartbreak. Japan won on penalty kicks.
Yeah.
Will you join me in hoping the championship will not be decided that way this time around?
I mean, I'd rather watch a 10-0 game than watch a game decided by penalty kicks. And I will grant you that maybe there's no other way to do it. Maybe, you know, it's just the way it has to be. I would much rather have two teams tie for the World Cup and get to hold it for 6 months than watch penalty kicks.
However that final turns out, Fox seems to have decided that women's soccer is worth broadcasting. The network is going to carry 10 National Women's Soccer League games through the remainder of the current season, including the playoffs. Does this seem to you a significant decision in terms of the future of the women's pro game?
Fox is a major player in televised soccer in the United States, and this can only be to the good.
Charlie, if there are any Sepp Blatter fans left, I'm sure they were happy to learn this week that he owns a golden cross that was blessed by Pope Francis. He believes that anybody who associates him with the recent FIFA scandal should be in jail. And Sepp Blatter is sure that he will go to heaven. So, no more piling on him, I guess.
Yeah, he also says there is no hell. I suggest he take that up with the migrant laborers in Qatar who have been living hell ever since he awarded the World Cup in a crooked fashion to that particular gas station with a flag and a seat at the UN.
He doesn't seem to have gotten off the hook at all.
No, not at all. Not as far as I'm concerned, no.
Wimbledon has brought accusations that some players are cheating because they're being coached while matches are in progress, and that is against the rules. But if all the players are being coached while the matches are in progress, is it still cheating?
I don't know. I mean, why is this a problem for sports?
Because it's tennis, and tennis has rules.
I mean, every athlete I know is coached during the competition. What would Bill Belichick think? You know what? Bill Belichick would be coaching his tennis players from the stands secretly with his secret Jedi hand signals.
Which is pretty much probably the way the guys who are doing it as well. Speaking of cheating, a shampoo company has decided that the slogan "doping for the hair" is, after all, not appropriate for use during the Tour de France, which gets underway this weekend. I don't know. I kind of like it when a sponsor makes fun of itself in an ad campaign. What do you think?
Well, yeah, but then again, somebody with a very large stick up the wrong part of their body decided, as the guy said, quote, "We have to distinguish clearly between the claims of an effective product and fraud in sports." I still think I would buy Alpecin because I want my hair to be dope. Also fresh and fly because I can communicate with the Ute.
What did he say? What did he say?
Nice lawn you've got here, Pops.
And finally, Charlie, the Seaport Deli on Long Island has named a sandwich after Mets pitcher Steven Matz. It's a chicken cutlet, got cheese and bacon on it. Sounds pretty good. So when he visited the Seaport Deli, I'm assuming he ordered one.
Actually, he didn't. He ordered an Aaron Boone, which Matz says is a more quote-unquote standard sandwich. Come on, Matz.
Eat the sandwich.
Get with the damn program.
I wonder if they changed the sandwich name as soon as he left.
Yeah, heck with him. I would have.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Fans. The word derives from fanatics, and some of them are. Enough of them so that Justine Gubar, ESPN producer, decided to investigate the phenomenon of fans gone wild. The result is Fanaticus, subtitled Mischief and Madness in the Modern Sports Fan. Justine Gubar, welcome to Only a Game.
It's great to be here.
You yourself had some unpleasant, even frightening experiences with fans. Let's begin with a firsthand account or two regarding obnoxious fan behavior that you experienced up close.
As a producer for ESPN, I was spending some time back in 2011 in Columbus, Ohio. I was covering the Ohio State football program. Things were not going well. The football program was undergoing scandal. The head coach had just resigned. Fans were desperate and defensive. Any member of the national media was sort of considered the enemy. Someone had published my home number on the internet, and I got pretty hateful voicemail messages that were so bad I actually had to call the police and file a police report. So all that hatred, I started wondering, what's going on here?
You studied fandom in Europe and in Asia and in Latin America as well as in the U.S. Can you generalize about fan behavior in one place or another?
Well, it's hard, but the one thing I did come away with in Fanaticus is that there is a universality to bad behavior. I found evidence of inappropriate behavior at the most elite levels of sport and the lowest, most amateur grassroots level of sport. Sure, it takes different forms in different countries, but it seems to be something within human nature and may harken back to our hunter-gatherer origins that were tribal.
In the chapter titled The Age of Entitlement, you explore the possibility that rowdy, even criminal behavior by fans happens because those fans are charged prices they feel are too high for entertainment that doesn't live up to its billing. Those fans feel like they've been ripped off, as if they're victims. Did actual fans say that to you?
Yes. You hear that sentiment from a lot of people. You go to a ballpark and people remember the price of their tickets.
You conclude the chapter titled, "And Then We Burn the Couch," with this contention. It may be time for the sports world to acknowledge that just about anyone can turn into a rioter. What led you to believe that?
Well, it's interesting. Nobody really steps up and says, "Yeah, I wanted to burn that couch." There's a real sort of attitude of, "I was there. I'm not a bad guy or girl. I just sort of went along with the crowd." Now, some of that may be excuses, but if you talk to rioters, there's just a vague sense of a lack of control. Maybe you're not the guy who lights the fire in the dumpster, but being surrounded by that energy and that stimulation, and maybe you have a few beers on you, it's not such a huge step to think that you might throw some newspaper on that fire.
As you point out, and I'm quoting now, people have been trying to figure out how to control crowds for centuries. Do you feel fan behavior in general is worse or more dangerous today than it was in ancient Rome, for example, or at premiership soccer matches 40 years ago?
That is a hard question to answer. The metrics in this area are sketchy. For example, if you're comparing arrest statistics at an NFL stadium from this year to 5-10 years ago, what are these numbers really showing you? Is it showing you that more people are misbehaving, less people are misbehaving, or that there's a zero tolerance policy, or that the laws have changed? So it's hard to know, but what I have found is important is that it feels like it's getting worse. You know, I hear fans who say it's not what it once was. And if the perception is there, if I have people coming up to me and telling me, "I don't want to take my kids to the game," then it's something that needs to be looked at and reacted to.
Justine Gubars, the author of Fanaticus, Mischief and Madness in the Modern Sports Fan. Justine, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Quiz time. What's the fastest growing sport in Minnesota? Hockey, basketball, soccer, something having to do with one of the state's 10,000 lakes? Wrong, wrong, and wrong. Recently, Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker met with some high school kids who were helping revive an old shooting sport.
It's a warm Wednesday afternoon in late May, and gunshots are echoing off the trees next to a rural highway in northern Minnesota. It's after school, and this open field is packed with middle and high school kids brandishing 12-gauge shotguns. There are groups of five shooters spaced apart. In one group, a girl with her hair pulled back under a camouflaged hat yells,
"Pull!"
A little bright orange clay disc 4 inches across zooms out over the Proctor Gun Club's grassy field. She aims her gun and fires. And the little clay pigeon breaks apart in midair. 1 point for the Hermantown High School trap shooting team.
It's difficult at first. Yeah, it's very difficult at first. But once you get the hang of it, it's kind of second nature to you, I guess.
This is Erin Flagg. She's a senior at Hermantown, the team manager, and one of just three girls on the team.
It's kind of fun to, because some weeks, some days, I'll outshoot the boys and I feel pretty good about myself.
Flagg grew up around guns. Her dad's a hunter, but she didn't know anything about trap shooting.
I had heard about it through my sister. She had a couple friends who were into it. And I came and watched her a couple times, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was kind of fun. It was different. It was interesting.
Back when Erin Flagg joined, there were just a handful of kids who shot trap at Hermantown. The year before, a student had approached math teacher Guy LeBlanc about helping start a team. So he agreed to make the case to the school board.
The school board wasn't real receptive to it, you know, and I understand, with guns in school. So we had to agree to not have the guns on campus, of course.
LeBlanc had never shot trap, but he hunted pheasants and ducks. And he told the school board, "These aren't the kind of kids you have to worry about.
These are the kids that respect the guns and hunt and fish and know the outdoors. And they know that there's one screw up and something bad's going to happen. And it keeps them from playing these stupid video games."
The school board relented. A team was formed. And the next year, Josh Rollins started competing as a freshman.
And our first year, I know, I would come here and I'd be able to shoot in 10 minutes and leave.
But as word got out around school, the team grew and grew.
And now I have to wait like half an hour to an hour to get down to a line. So it's really been growing.
There are now 45 kids on Hermantown's team. That's more than there were in the entire state only 7 years ago. This year, statewide, there are more than 8,600 shooters competing. It's by far Minnesota's fastest-growing school sport. I called up John Nelson with the Minnesota Trap Shooting League and asked him, what's behind that incredible growth?
From a school's perspective, we provide a safe program. We've never had an injury. This also helps comply as an adaptive sport, so kids who have physical disabilities can participate in shooting sports. We have many kids that shoot from wheelchairs. This is a co-ed sport. This is a program that is open to all.
Okay, but what about the kids? Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons. Here's Hermantown coach Guy LeBlanc again.
It fits the niche of a different kid. You know, most of our kids, I think there's 45 kids in our team this year. There's about 28, 29 of them that don't play another sport. They're not in band, choir, drama. This is their thing. And you don't have to be 6'2" and 220 pounds to be effective at it.
Which helps senior Josh Rollins, who's, well, just a normal-sized teenager with glasses and curly hair tucked under a ball cap. For him, trap shooting was a natural fit.
I get to shoot guns, and it helps improve how I shoot because I duck hunt and I deer hunt, and this is a lot like duck hunting.
Like a lot of kids growing up in northern Minnesota, hunting is a big part of his life, something he grew up doing with his parents.
My dad always gives me crap. Oh, you can't hit the broadside of a barn, Josh. So I come here and I shot against him and I beat him. So that made me pretty happy.
And what about Erin Flagg, the senior we met at the beginning of the story? She wasn't a big hunter growing up. She played soccer and basketball and other after-school activities.
I was involved with a dance team this past season, but this is my primary sport this year, so.
So dance and then trap shooting. Some people yeah. might say, what the heck?
Yeah, definitely both ends of the spectrum there, yeah. It's get all dressed up, put makeup on, put your hair up, and dance to a song, and then come out, put your camel hat on, and shoot the guys.
Last month, two of Flagg's teammates competed in the state finals. While they weren't among the top finishers, they're helping to blaze a trail for young shooters in other states. Minnesota was the first state to start a trap shooting league. Now organizers have started a U.S. clay target league to duplicate the Minnesota model nationwide. This year, organizers helped start leagues in Wisconsin and North Dakota. By next year, five or six states are expected to have leagues. For Only a Game, I'm Dan Crocker.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. Our intern is Joe Jacobs. And our senior producer is Gary Waller. Our final word comes from President Calvin Coolidge, who sums up his latest presidential race at Nationals Park.
These results are not fanciful. They are not imaginary. They are grimly actual and real, reaching into every household in the land.
Well, I don't know about every house. I mean, not everybody's a Nationals fan. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.